Scripture reading this morning is from Hosea, chapter 13, verses 1 through 8. Hosea, chapter 13, verses 1 through 8. When Ephraim spoke, there was trembling. He exalted himself in Israel, but through Baal he did wrong and died. And now they sin more and more, and make for themselves molten images, idols skillfully made from their silver, all of them the work of craftsmen. They say of them, "Let the men who sacrifice kiss the calves." Therefore they will be like the morning cloud, like the dew which soon disappears, like chaff which is blown away from the threshing floor, and like smoke from a chimney. Yet I have been the Lord your God since the land of Egypt, and you are not to know any God except me, for there is no Savior besides me. I cared for you in the wilderness, in the land of drought. As they had their pasture, they became satisfied. In being satisfied, their heart became proud. Therefore, they forgot me. So I will be like a lion to them. Like a leopard, I will lie in wait by the wayside. I will encounter them like a bear robbed of her cubs, and I will tear open their chest. There I will also devour them like a lioness, as a wild beast would tear them.
The lesson this morning is taken from the book of Hosea. From our opening passage, we see that the prophet Hosea actually served God during the time of Hezekiah and Jotham and Ahaz and Uzziah and through Joash, the king of Israel. In the 8th century B.C., the prophet Hosea was sent to preach to the northern tribes of Israel. Israel was rapidly falling away from God, led by the example of the greatest tribe, Ephraim. We've been studying in Genesis about Ephraim, one of the sons of Joseph. And it was one of the larger tribes. It received, you know, greater blessings, preeminence. They had a good start with God's blessings. And we're seeing what began to happen with Ephraim as it turned away from God. The political atmosphere was becoming so bad that four of Israel's last six kings had been murdered. How God sees the nation at the time is a vital insight and warning really for all nations, including ours now. The intrigues, the erroneous solutions that Israel seeks to correct its problems in its dealings with the Almighty are a sobering example of the wrong way to approach survival with horrible consequences. The relationship between Israel and its God is also a good illustration of what can go wrong in our personal relationships, either with God or with parents and mentors meaning teachers, friends, anything, you know, where we draw some sort of instruction, our guidance in growing up. And so we're just going to a few of the examples of the illustrations or the visions that Hosea saw as an explanation of what was happening to Ephraim. It begins with Hosea 7 and 8, where the vision that that Hosea had was of Ephraim mixing himself with the nations. Ephraim has become a cake not turned. In this life, there are many relationships to be built, whether as an individual or a nation. As a Christian, one must balance properly one's obligation to serving God and one's responsibility to govern powers as instituted by God. So on a national level, we know there's all sorts of influences in the world. We know in the growth of our own country that there are things that impacted it, both internally and externally. We realized at one point we couldn't be just isolationists, that we had to have a part in the world around us in order to maintain our own sovereignty and our own protection. But, in fact, even as we started, Israel, this nation realized that it had to build its foundation upon the teachings of God. But somewhere, you know, we went wrong. When the two conflict, That is, when the pressures around us, which should be a help to us, and the things that God tells us to do, one's faith and loyalty must turn totally to God, because he has the preeminent wisdom. He knows best how to tell us what to do in all circumstances. However hot the situation gets, to survive must turn like a cake. We may not have that example nowadays. Think of anything you want to, where if you put something over the fire, it could be a roasted chicken, I don't know. But you know you have to keep turning it in order for it to not cook just on one side or burn, and then the other side be raw. And so the same example was given to Ephraim. You got to keep turning. You know, you can't just, what they were doing was settling down into looking to the nations for their help, to looking for others for help. And they were gradually turning away from God. And so their character was becoming very raw in its relationship with its creator, and becoming very too overtly depending on the nations around them. Ephraim failed to turn and so let himself be consumed by the burning desires of the nations around. We also, personally, we have pressures around. There are things that we look to, we know that are important, that are going to make us better people. But too often, we look at our situation and go, well, this is the most important thing. And it might be school. How often do we as students, because of the pressure of getting, you know, the homework done, getting studying for the grades or whatever, or for the job, you know, to working to make a living, to provide for our family, we let that have preeminence. And then we become a cake not turned. That is, you know, not realizing that most of our strength in this time, most of the resources and opportunities that are out there, they come from God. The blessings that we have, the gifts that we have, all come from God. And when we keep putting God off to say, well, I got to get through school first, you know, it's an excuse. You know, when we say, well, I've got a job to do. I mean, these are old excuses. Go back, you know, with the things in the world. Someone came to Augustine one time and said, man has to eat, doesn't he? Or man has to live, doesn't he? And Augustine said, does he? And there's times we're going to be faced with it. You know, what's most important? You know, God should be chosen above all things, even if it costs us, you know, perhaps some grades in school or a little bit of harshness in the career we've chosen. You know, the choices you make often, you know, if the pressure is on to either have a job or to serve God, the choice should be easy. You know, forget the job. There's times I realize personally I've had to make that choice, and I'll tell you straight off, the choice for God has always been the better one. God looks after you. You know, there's not a job that I left that I didn't get something better when I did leave. You know, God's going to look after you, but you have to have that courage. You have to have that trust. You have to have that faith. You know, if you keep putting other things, whether it's recreation or your career or school, what are we telling our kids? What are we showing our kids? That when they grow up, if you can find any kind of excuse, you can put it before serving God, before being here for worship. And this is one of the things you have to worry about. Brad, you know, Dan did a good job last Wednesday. You know, when someone says, you know, you can find all sorts of things to busy yourself with. I mean, sometimes they can get almost silly. People that fill their house with knickknacks, and their excuse is, well, I have all this dusting to do. Well, take your right hand and go like this over the table, get rid of all the knickknacks, you know, and you'll be surprised how much free time you've got. Or if you have a garden, you know, they just, well, I got to tend the garden all day. And you go to that, and you don't have time for study or for God or for people or whatever. You've got your priorities wrong. You know? Take a flamethrower and burn all the plants down. You'll be surprised how much free time you have for more important things. And this is what God was trying to tell Ephraim. In Hosea 13, when Ephraim spoke, there was trembling. I think we read part of this. He exalted himself in Israel, but through the Baal, he did wrong and he died. And now they sin more and more. They turn to the wrong kind of God. And they make for themselves the golden, the molten images. Now, the idols were skillfully made out of silver. They probably looked at these gods and said, well, these are the best things that people ever made. The trouble is, you know, what Isaiah shows, it's made by you. Why do you worship it? Why don't you worship that which makes you God? So they say to them, let the men who sacrifice kiss the calves. This is the problem in northern Israel. After the death of Solomon, you call historically that the kingdoms were split. We had Jeroboam to the north and Rehoboam ruling in the south. In order to keep the people from going to Jerusalem to worship and then maybe losing their loyalty and support, Jeroboam set up calf worship in the north and in the south. And that's what the people turned to. Turn back to the calves. And that's what it's talking about. They kiss the calves instead of being devoted and paying homage to their Lord. So the next illustration follows logically. Hosea 7:11, the prophet says, so Ephraim has become like a silly dove. Without sense, they call to Egypt, they call to Assyria. Ephraim had become like some dumb animal, you know, flitting from one water hole to another, not realizing that's where the hunters are, waiting to trap them. Running to its enemies for help. I thought one of the interesting things, funny things almost, long before the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein in Iraq declared war on Iran. And there was a big fight between the two of them. I think we supported Saddam at the time, so he had our planes, our tanks, whatever. But then when we in the Gulf War went against Saddam Hussein, funniest thing, in order to protect the things that he had, I remember him flying his planes over to Iran and parking them on the runway, saying, you know, telling his enemies, would you take care of these while we're engaged in war so we don't want to lose them? And then afterwards, when they went back and said, can we have our planes back? Iran goes, you've got to be kidding. Ephraim was doing the same thing. You know, going from, you know, Egypt looking for their support to going to Syria looking for their support. And both of them were looking out for themselves. They could care less what Israel wanted. So turning for salvation to their political strategies, hoping to pit nation against nation, but instead they got caught between a vice and finally swallowed up in it. Both of them. Jeremiah got hauled away to Egypt into captivity. The northern tribes got hauled away into Assyrian captivity. Where they should have gone was to God for protection. Like angry children, instead of seeking his advice, they raged against him. You know, a lot of times children get so emotionally overwrought that the very ones that protect them. And when you stop to think about it, a child in the house throwing a tantrum against the people that take care of them, protect them, provide them a place to stay, provide food for them, shelter, you know, clothes, and this person you're going to get mad at and maybe try to make them mad at you. You know, no wonder they're pictured as a silly dove. Hosea 7:10, though the pride of Israel, the prophets, testifies against them, yet they have neither returned to the Lord their God, nor have they sought him for all of this. So the pride, the prophets that God sent to them to try to warn them, to try to give them some good instruction, you know, they backed off, they backed away from. And even as we were studying through Luke, where Jesus condemns the Pharisees because they go and they honor the prophets with these big sepulchers and everything else, and yet he says, you testify to the very fact that you're the sons of your fathers. Your fathers are the ones that put them in the tombs, you know, and you're going to show what to them when you're making the same, you know, you're doing the same thing that they did, rejecting those that God sends to you. So Isaiah 7 and 14, and they do not cry to me from the heart when they wail on their beds. They turn away from me. Yeah. The one that can solve all their problems is God. And they're the one, he's the one they turn away from. But now God, and this is something that people overlook, is that God will turn on us when we turn away from God. It's not a matter of, you know, just going along and using the excuse, well, things are getting bad, you know, God's not with me anymore, therefore God's the bad guy. The problem has always been when we turn away from God, things start getting sour. Now is not a time then to rail against God, because now you've made God mad. And if you think situations are bad enough, you know, wait till you get God against you. You know, he can make things so much worse, unimaginable. Notice Hosea 7 and 12. So they go, I spread my net over them, you know, like that silly bird at the whatever watering hole it is. I'll bring them down like the birds of the sky. Or, was also read by Phil, I will encounter them like a bear robbed of her cubs. And we're kind of familiar with that around here. Some have had some bear encounters, and mostly people know that, you know, if the cubs are present, you give mama a wide berth. Yeah, we just know the rage of a mother for the cubs. Therefore, I will devour them like I will tear them open in the chest. I will also devour them like a lioness, as a wild beast would tear. It is your destruction, O Israel, that you are against me, against your help. Where now is your king, that he may save you in all your cities, and your judges of whom you requested? Give me a king and princes. This goes back to the beginning where Israel got dissatisfied with God and decided they wanted a king just like the nations around them. And so God chose Saul to give him to begin with. But where did all their blessings come from? You know, no king ever gave it to them. In fact, you know, what we rehearsed before, I mean, just starting off with the beginning of Israel, they were slaves in the land of Egypt. In fact, they're described as the smallest of people. That's why God chose them, to demonstrate his strength, just as he chose David against Goliath. You know, God doesn't need what most people look to for strength. So he chose the smallest of people, the Israelites, and he took them away from the most powerful nation in history at the time. And there's nothing the Egyptians could do about it. He rescued them from their power. He saved them in the crossing of the sea, the destruction of the Egyptian army. As they went across the wilderness, he made sure their clothes didn't wear out, their shoes didn't wear out. They were fed and watered every day. They were protected from their enemies. When they got into Canaan, the land filled with flowing with milk and honey, and he told them, you know, you're going to acquire cities, walled cities that you didn't build. 60 castle-like cities in Bashan alone. You're going to have cisterns you did not dig, all sorts of wells. You're going to have vineyards you didn't plant. There was nobody, no people that were better looked after or more blessed than God. He destroyed all the enemies around him. As they went in to conquer the land of Canaan, God did most of the work, driving the people away with hailstones or whatever natural disaster he could come up with. They forgot all the source of the things that they had. And they made God mad. I gave you a king in my anger. I'm going to take him away in my wrath. You're going to see that your king can't do anything for you. Your false prophets can't do anything. Your own strength can't do anything. You're going to other nations, can't do anything for you. Should have turned to me to begin with. In fact, God's lament is Hosea 10:1. Israel is a luxuriant vine. He produces fruit for himself. The more his fruit, the more altars he made, the richer his land, the better he made the sacred pillars. As things were beginning to bless, he looked, you know, to his own confidence. He looked to his own strength. He looked to his own gods that he made. And he forgot about the one true God. God had a cause to be upset. He had invested a lot in Israel. In fact, they owed all they were to what he had made them. And now they were casting him off. They're primarily a Stone Age people going into a Bronze Age area. And God looked after them. He had seen their fathers like a lovely vine with a great potential for fruit. But the latter crop turned out to be an abysmal failure. In fact, this concept of the first fruits is something that's carried on in the New Testament, where Paul talks about the Christians being first fruits with good potential. You know, this is what God began to work with in New Testament times. But he says of Israel, in Hosea 9 and 10, I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your forefathers as the earliest fruit on the fig tree, you know, in its first season. He took something wild and domesticated it and made it even more abundant. In Hosea 10, it says their heart is faithless. Now they must bear their guilt. Not their fruit, their guilt. The Lord will break down their altars and destroy their sacred pillars. Surely now they will say, we have no king, for we do not revere the Lord. As for the king, what can he do for us? Now that God is no longer their king, God is not doing for them either. Still today, we are what God has made us, as a nation and as an individual. But our nation, too, is filled with moral corruption, social injustices, spiritual whoredom, and distrust in God. Would Hosea look upon us and see the same cake and silly dove and luxuriant vine and prophesy the same destruction on us? If the answer is yes, it's time to start working to reverse our situation, our view in the eyes of God. Or, barring sometimes it's hard to turn a nation around. In fact, there was something I just saw recently. Most of the turning of nations has been by small groups. The Nazis in Germany were not the majority. The Bolsheviks in Russia were not the majority. They're about 8%. Certain individuals in Japan, you know, were not the majority. Most of them were, you know, peace-loving, whatever. One person said of all this, the majority is irrelevant because it doesn't do anything. In this country, it was only a minority that started a revolution. You know, only a third of our nation wanted to do the right thing, fought for freedom. A third were still with the British. The other third just sat there and watched. In every turn of a nation, it's never been what the majority wanted. It's just what a few wanted. It can turn it good or turn it bad. You know, our voice needs to be out there. You know, not just for the sake of a nation or people, but for the sake of God, for Christians. Even if it comes down to that we become irrelevant among a majority, then we can look at ourselves personally, either as a church or as an individual, as a Christian. You know, what we learn from the Old Testament is a lot of times it's just individuals that serve God that stood alone, whether it was Noah or Elijah or sometimes Moses. Yeah. But who won? Who won out? Who did God favor? And who did the blessings of God reside in? Not only in the time of their time, but also into eternity and the salvation of their souls. Where is your heart personally? What are your idols that you hold dearer than God? To what do you trust, if not the Lord? I mean, could you walk away from everything you have right now? The rich young ruler was told to. How much do you depend on? Do you got to have the job? Do you have to have the school? Do you have to have the money in the bank? Do you have to have the house you're living in, whatever, or all the things you've collected around you? Or if God said, if Christ came to your door and said, come follow me, could you leave it all behind and trust in him only? That's a big question and a lot to ask, but something that each one of us has to face. You know, each one as a disciple has to pick up his cross and follow Jesus, which means there's some things you're agonizingly going to have to crucify in yourself, you know, in your worldliness. If one is to find any worth in life or any salvation in eternity, it can only be in the devoted service of the Almighty. And this is what God calls us to. If there's anything we can do to help you make yourself right with your God, it begins with a single step of entering the waters of baptism after a decision is made in your own mind, in heart, you know, to quit a life that's dedicated to the world and now decide you want to serve God. You enter the waters of baptism and have your sins washed away. The things that separated you from God can now be eliminated. And you can serve God in your innocence, you know, with a clear conscience. This is what God says he can do for us. And this is something that no man can do for you. Have the sin, your sins remitted and forgiven by your Creator. Also, any kind of problems that you have a powerful resource in the church, in righteous people, that you can offer, you know, you can ask their prayers. And James says, the prayer of a righteous man availeth much. So all these things are to your advantage that you won't find in the world. There are things that God offers to you only for those that want to serve him. The invitation is extended. Won't you come as we stand to sing?
Time is gone.